You're listening to the History Today podcast. In this episode, Charlotte Crow talks to Onyeka about his article in the July issue of the magazine concerning African gentlemen in Georgian England.
You start your article referencing a claim by two historians who say that the African presence in Britain in the Georgian era could be akin to the number of Africans in the UK today. Now, that sort of a claim is going to surprise a lot of people, but clearly it points to an invisibility of the African presence in Britain historically. And I'd like you to tell us a little bit about how those sorts of how we can be sure, or how we can have a greater idea of the evidence and presence of Africans in Britain.
Yes.
In the 18th century.
Yes. Hitherto, we have thought, or been the way it's been approached to us through historians like E.P. Thompson and others, is that the 18th century was a period in which there wasn't much racial diversity present within the British Isles. However, recent research over the last sort of 40 or 50 years has uncovered and revealed an African presence in parish records throughout the 18th century, from the beginning until the 18th. And this 18th century African presence is to be found throughout the British Isles, from Edinburgh all the way down south to Dover. And these Africans are to be found in cities, villages and towns throughout the British Isles. They include people like John Edmund Stone in Edinburgh, the taxidermist who taught Charles Darwin his taxidermy when he was a young man. They include Caesar Picton from Thames Ditton, the entrepreneur and coal merchant. They include people from Blackpool, and they include the circus proprietor Pablo Fanique and his travelling circus. So they include a range of different Africans in a range of different professions up and down the country, from as far north as Edinburgh and as far south as Dover and as far west as the Cornish Peninsula.
And what about ordinary people whose names might not have been sort of recorded for posterity, i.e. taxidermist of Darwin?
Yes, there are Africans to be found inside the Merchant Navy and the Royal Navy. Africans participated throughout the Georgian period in the Napoleonic Wars on the British side. There were Africans present on HMS Victory at the Battle of Trafalgar. And they are to be displayed and portrayed on the picture of Daniel Maclise showing Nelson being killed at the Battle of Trafalgar. There's also an image of an African gunner on the plinth of Trafalgar Square, also showing Lord Nelson's death. So Africans will be found inside the Merchant Navy, inside the British Army, people like George Rose.
So in view of this very lucid range of people that you've just described, you charge in your current article people like E.P. Thompson with helping to build, and other historians, and not just E.P. Thompson, but to build a distorted view of the African presence, not so much in terms of invisibility, but in terms of Africans as victims, as inferior.
I mean, in some ways we're indebted to E.P. Thompson because some of his socio-historical work is very much important in terms of our understanding of the 18th century. And even people such as the author of Staying Power, Peter Fryer, his work on Africans or black people throughout the British Isles also is a very important text. However, hitherto the idea has been that Africans had a very servile or low status. This is perhaps a reflection or a reality based upon a concept based upon the notion that Britain in the 18th century had become the largest, if not the largest, slave trading nation in the world. And as the British Empire was only rivaled by France, and perhaps the Ottoman Empire, in terms of the outreach of its slave trading enterprises, so that external to the British Isles, Britain was enslaving more people probably than anybody else. So the obvious conclusion or theory that runs from that is that any Africans that were then present in Britain whilst Britain was enslaving people elsewhere must have had a servile status comparable to what Africans had in the British colonies. But in fact, that is not true. The status of people varied, even within the colonies, but certainly within the British Isles. Even though there were laws within the empire, which sort of, in a roundabout way, justified the commerce and trade that made Africans servile, inside British society, no such laws could be enforced in those same ways. If we know anything about slavery, we know that it was enforced through violence and through custom. And that violence couldn't be justified inside British courts. It wasn't just the matter of the famous case of Somerset, which said, you know, that recounting from Cartwright in 1569, that England was too pure an air for a slave to breathe. It's not just that notion that was present in there, but also about custom and tradition. Most Africans inside the 18th century were integrated and assimilated within British society.
Right, well, let me stop you at that point, because that brings us on to this article that you've written for the July issue. And you've called it Black Equestrians, and it's about a particular group of assimilated Africans, if you can call them a group, because they are all very individual. But a lot of people might not understand exactly what you mean when you use the term equestrian. And I'd like you to explain that term a little bit, please, so that we can talk about the individuals that you mentioned.
Yeah. In the 18th century, many Englishmen, looking back, like Pope and others, looking back at the culture and traditions of Rome and ancient Greece, looked to identify a mode, a way, a fashion of being. And they looked to ancient Rome and they looked to ancient Greece to do it. And inside ancient Rome, there was a class of people called equestrians. And this equestrian class and the patrician class that came through the equestrian class governed and functioned in terms of a middle class and an upper class within Roman society, really from the beginning of the founding of Rome in the 8th century all the way up to its demise. So adopting what they thought were the mores of this class, through the writings of Cicero and the writings of Caesar and the writings of various other Roman authors, they created a notion within modern Britain that they wanted to emulate the equestrian style. And they began to call themselves equestrians, or the new Greeks, began to dress in togas like Greeks or ancient Romans. And they began to read and write and speak in Latin.
We're talking about the Augustan era.
And part of the justification of the British Empire was the emulation, in fact, that it was the descendant of this ancient Roman empire. And so the adopting of the equestrian values was, even in its most truncated form, because obviously this is a translation of those values.
And it's a cultural one, isn't it?
It's a cultural translation. It's a fashion one. It's a mores one. It's an adopting of what they think are the equestrian mores, what they think are the equestrian ideals, or how they are interpreting those equestrian ideals.
And those ideals linked very much to the idea of being a Georgian gentleman.
Yes.
A gentle person.
A gentleman. And a gentleman not necessarily gentle in the sense of how we would think of being gentle, but being a gentleman in the sense of being a gentleman. And being an 18th century gentleman, we might consider now to be rather coarse and raucish and obtuse. But they actually feel that that was also part of an equestrian ideal. So this equestrian ideal was a generic term that encompassed many different values. Because even within the equestrian order, there was a pseudo kind of equestrian, a pseudo Epicureanism. This pseudo Epicureanism was extravagant, was extreme. People would engage in orgies. They would engage in eating to excess and vomiting to excess. And many 18th century Englishmen, seeing that in ancient Greek and Roman texts, began to adopt those similar values. There was other equestrians, also part of the pseudo-equestrian philosophy, who believed in violent behaviour and a kind of aggressive kind of honour, where they would fight duels and kill one another based upon honour. And many people in Georgian England, also adopting those values, also took on the same mode and way of behaving, especially in relation to women and the way in which they treated women and people that they considered of a lower class.
OK, so it's a sort of a cultural identity that we can recognise from our understanding of the Georgian era. But now you've got to tell us something about the characters that inhabit your article.
Yes.
And let's start with Julius Subiz.
Julius is someone who we don't know too much factual evidence about him. So we know that he was of Jamaican descent, and we know that he was came from or through St. Kitts. And we know that he was a cabin boy on board a ship. Little else do we know about his background for firm in any firm way. Some people say that his mother or his father were white, but we do not know this for sure. What we do know is that when adopted inside British society, he achieved a position based upon his skills, abilities, and adopting these same values which he himself was reading about. And we also know that in some ways, some people in Georgian society regarded him as being uppity and of getting ideas beyond his station. And that is why he was sometimes referred to as the Mungo Macaroni. The Mungo being the character from the padlock by George or John Dibden. John Dibden, the padlock of the 18th century. And the Macaroni being a reference to the idea of this ostentatious, flamboyant European man who's exceeded the boundaries of fashion. So he was the archetypal Mungo Macaroni, and he was a popular and fashionable figure long before Beau Brummel in 18th century society, and in many ways emulated many of the values and customs that were coming from France.
You're also talking about a very different type of equestrian when you talk about Subuiz's friend, Ignatius Sancho, who people might have heard of more frequently.
Yes.
How is Sancho different and other than in his equestrianism from Subuiz?
Yes. Ignatius Sancho, in many ways, is an equestrian more like a Cicero, a more quiet, intellectual, quietly spoken family man who seems to have spent the latter part of his years in a very pedestrian, sedentary way with his family, while eating and drinking rather too much to excess, and therefore suffering from the gentleman's disease of gout. And then, once in his more senior years, becoming a shop keeper and owner, and quietly, through the letters that he wrote to people like Lawrence Stern and others, beginning to influence public opinion against slavery in a very English, quiet, sophisticated manner, but nevertheless having a strong abhorrence for it, but in a very gentlemanly way going about challenging that abhorrent practice. Ignatius Sancho is a very interesting individual because in many ways he emulates the very concepts that we're talking about. He is an African and refers to himself as such. And yet he is also extremely English in the way in which he thinks of the world. And his viewpoint is as a middle-stroke, upper-class gentleman. For example, in 1780, during the Gordon Riots.
He's quite conservative, isn't he?
He is quite conservative, with a small C.
Yes.
Because he also has another aspect to his being.
Yes.
The conservative with a small C, in a sense, because when he sees these Gordon Riots happening, he doesn't feel inclined to rush out onto the street and join them. No, he's actually offended by the behaviour and considers it raucous and ungentlemanly and is to a certain extent abhorred by the activities, but nevertheless feels sympathy and hopes, he says, that it will rain. And if it rains, then they'll be taken home and they won't be hurt or damaged and they won't damage or hurt anybody else. But also, in a certain sense, there is a liberal strain that runs through his ideological philosophy. And we can see this being exercised quietly in the people that he decides to vote for during the general election of the same year, in which he votes for radicals, inverted commas, and liberals, in inverted commas. Not the conservative with a large C, but conservative with a small C.
Yes. We ought to just point out that the activists like Aquino, who are fighting, you know, for abolition and those people you've chosen to sort of leave out of the equestrian debate for now, haven't you?
Yes, that's because I feel so many people have written so much about them.
Yes.
That I thought it more appropriate to talk about those people who are not so well known, including Julius, including perhaps Ignatius, and certainly the third person.
Well, George Augustus Bridgetower, who died in Peckham in 1860, aged 82, left an estate of £1,000. Now, he's the final person that you go into great detail about in your piece.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about how he came to leave £1,000. And, you know, he died in the Victorian era,
Indeed. So
he's sort of post-Georgian in a sense.
Yes. I mean, the thing about George Augustus Polygreen Bridgetower is that he's coming from, he spans two time spans. He's both within the Georgian and within the Victorian era. And really his story is the story of at least two or three gentlemen of the Georgian period. The first one being his father, who escapes bondage in the Caribbean and then moves his way around Europe, becoming at first a servant to the crown princes of various Eastern European countries, and then making himself welcome and servant to various other dignitaries and nobles throughout Europe, and then finding his way through France to this country. And when in this country, his skill, both within Greek, Latin, and as a gentleman, are well noted. But most of all, his skill as a musician. And he's already teaching his children, both of his children being his sons, being born to a mother from Poland. And these children who he has educated and taught not only the language of music, but the language of a gentleman, these gentlemen in some ways outstretch him, especially the youngest son, George Augustus Polygreen Bridgetower. And this youngest son becomes a child protege. He is the most adept and skillful musician, and respected not only in this country but throughout Europe. His concerts are sellout, and his skill as a musician is noted by royalty, and he's employed by George III in his orchestra, and then subsequently and continuously employed by George III for the next few decades.
Well, it's fascinating. Thank you very much. Just finally, this week the film Belle is released, and you do mention Dido Elizabeth Belle in the article, but the article isn't really focusing on African female experience. But can I just ask you quickly what your view is of films such as Belle and how they might help us reshape our understanding of the 18th century experience?
I think films are wonderful things if they help to inspire us to think of a time period in a different way or reignite our understanding of history. I don't think we can ever put to one side anything that stimulates our understanding of history, because as you keep saying, and as you say, history today, what happens then is very important to what happens now. But my equivocation is this: having been brought up, you know, throughout the 80s, 70s, 80s and early 90s on a certain kind of production that presents an image of Britain in the absence of any racial ethnic diversity, and many people seeing those sorts of images will therefore concur that Britain didn't have diversity, and that diversity is a question of modernity where all the problems are. So this film attempts to place Dido Elizabeth Lindsay Bell in that milieu. However, not to detract away from the film, what is important is that what we need is a film that speaks about the diversity of that period in a more generic sense.
Less exceptionalism.
Yeah, less exception. Rather than us just showing Belle as the only one. In fact, what we need to do is show that there were others like her. And in fact, communities, part of the British society. And that these were part of what made Georgian Britain Georgian.
Thank you very much, Onyeka.